right now. Welcome to Barnstorming PA. This is the 15th year commemorative episode following Paul Wellstone's death. He died tragically in 2002, a few days before his re-election campaign in 2002. He was a true true progressive champion for the people of the state of Minnesota, and we're just so sad that he's gone and are very interested in the legacy that he leaves behind. My name is Taylor. I'm one of the co-hosts here on Barnstorming.
Hi, this is Jordy Comis. I'm another one of your co-hosts. It's somewhat relevant today, or perhaps very relevant, that the year I went to Carleton College, where Paul Wellstone had been a professor, was the same fall that he won. And the first election I voted in as an 18-year-old was that election. And, you know, in terms of, I didn't even know how much difference there was then in voter laws. I could register the day of the election at the polling place in Pennsylvania. Just looking at, you have to register, I think, October 10th, like 5 weeks before.
Yeah,
ridiculous.
Yeah.
Hey, and this is Chip. This is a special podcast for me. Paul Wellstone is a hero and an icon for a lot of us. It was a sad day, and I appreciate that we have a special guest with us today.
Yeah, we're joined today by Representative David Bly. He serves in the Minnesota State Legislature, representing parts of Rice County in Northfield. Is that right? Is it just Rice County?
It's Northern Rice County and Eastern Le Sueur County.
Oh, okay. And Representative Bly represents Northfield, Minnesota, where Paul was a teacher at Carleton College. Two of the co-hosts have lived in Northfield, deep ties with Northfield. So welcome, Representative. Thank you so much for joining us today.
It's a pleasure. Thanks for inviting me.
Go ahead.
So you had asked about Paul's influence as a Northfield resident, and of course this is a day remembering the day that 15 years ago that he died, when a lot of us in Northfield and in Minnesota are thinking about Paul and Sheila, his wife, mm-hmm. and daughter, who all perished in that plane crash. Paul was a larger-than-life figure, which in a small town, you can imagine, sometimes isn't always the most comfortable person to have around.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And he was very passionate. He cared about a lot of things. He was a volunteer assistant wrestling coach in the high school, and liked working with youth. In addition to being a different kind of college professor at Carleton, and when I say that, what I mean is he was very interested not only in what students can learn from books, but what they can learn from their experience and their involvement with community. And while he was working with students at Carleton, he started an organization which he called A Better Rice County. And he had students working with local officials to fight poverty in Rice County. And I don't know that he necessarily made huge inroads in eliminating poverty from Rice County, but his students learned a lot from the people that they encountered who were struggling with poverty and some of the struggles that poverty produces. And one of those, the people that he and his students worked with, was a woman named Patty Fritz, who later ran for a House seat in the Minnesota House as well. And I served with her for a number of years.
Was that
and,
Fritz?
Fritz, yeah. And she worked very hard on poverty issues. And so as a lasting legacy for Paul, the work that she accomplished and worked on was a direct result of his engagement in the community. That's just one example. But I, at the time that he was beginning his venture into electoral politics, I for many years was a teacher in Alfreda School in Northfield, working with kids at risk, which, by the way, Paul had a special understanding for. And when he did become a senator, you may remember during his time of service, there was something called a No Child Left Behind initiative that involved a lot of testing. And he was one of the few senators who understood how this was a problem for kids who might struggle with school. And I think we've gone down a path of really stressing academics when that's not the only important thing that students learn when they're in school, but it's the easiest to measure. That's just a little aside. That I worked with Paul when he was a senator on some education issues in regard to that when I was working as a president of a education association here in Minnesota. But what I was going to say is that when he started his electoral campaign, I was then involved in the local Democratic Party and was at the time the Rice County chair. So Paul and Sheila contacted me to help with their first efforts to raise funds and things like that.
So you were there from the ground up.
Yeah, yes. Running for the Senate, I'm sorry, go ahead, do you have a question?
Yeah, no, I just was kind of like, maybe if you could take us back to that moment, you know, those early days, like, did it seem like, you know, he ran as the outsider and the underfunded candidate? I mean, did you think like, well, maybe he won't win, but at least we'll get our issues on the map? Or did you have a sense like maybe he could win?
Yes. Let me first say that the first office, statewide office that Paul ran for was actually state auditor.
Mm-hmm.
And he raised some very important issues, and I think he discovered his voice and campaign and the pleasures of campaigning with working people. And he didn't have really a prayer, I think, during that election, but he proved himself as a very strong campaigner and developed an ability to talk about issues that other politicians were not talking about. Just the other day, I listened to Minnesota Public Radio, and they played a tape from the early debate that he had with the sitting state auditor, and Paul identified himself as a farmer laborite. Now, not everybody who isn't familiar with Minnesota politics knows what I mean when I say that.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, a lot of Minnesotans don't realize that the DFL, the Democratic Farmer Labor Party, is actually the combination of two parties. And the Farmer Labor Party was a progressive party from the beginning, and it was made up of both Republicans, progressive Republicans, and Democrats who left their parties because the parties like today have become parties that are more supportive of an economic agenda that leaves local people behind. And the Farmer Labor Party emerged as a party that really dealt with the local concerns, the progressive concerns of people who lived in Minnesota and were dissatisfied with that. It did lead in the 1930s to the election of Floyd B. Olson, who was the first Farmer Labor governor, and then Governor Benson after him. But Paul identified with that kind of politics and was often talking about things that were happening back in the 80s when he ran for auditor, which had to do with farm foreclosures and union busting and things that were going on that a lot of people were not wanting to talk about. So he had sort of put himself out there several years earlier before he decided to run for senator. And I think one thing that I heard from people as he was running on both sides of the aisle is that they knew that Paul was someone who was very passionate and was very honest. And I think this also came through in his campaigning. The other thing that a few ads made use of is that he, along with his energy and his very optimistic and positive point of view, he had a good sense of humor. So I think that all played well in his campaigning. He was someone who managed to be able to really speak strongly for what he believed, and in fighting for working people, at the same time that he was pleasant about it. I mean, he didn't attack people personally. unlike our current president, who seems only to know how to do that.
Yeah.
But one of Paul's real strengths was being. I mean, I can remember when I first ran for the Minnesota House. I started my speech by talking about how awful Republicans were. And he sort of took me aside afterwards, and he said, "You know, you're going to want some of those Republicans to vote for you too.
Mm-hmm.
So don't be too dismissive of where they are, but try to talk positively about what you believe in and what you stand for."
Yeah.
And you know, I think in his case, there were Republicans who were willing to vote for him because he was respectful to them, but at the same time was very clear about what he stood for, and they knew that if they voted for him, they were voting. They knew what they were getting. You know, they knew who they were voting for.
I mean, I was
didn't shy away.
Yeah, today in preparation for this, I was I heard Paul speak at least twice. Once when I was a student, he came back for a convocation, and then my reunion cycle was on a cycle with I think a class that had his 25th reunion. That my memory is that they. When Carleton College actually tried to fire him because he was too active, this was the class that like rallied, and I think they did some civil disobedience. But anyway, in one of those speeches, he was talking. This was in '92. He was talking about how important it was to run his constituency services and to get letter. You know, that when people write their senator, they expect to get a response. And he said basically like, look, people know that even if they disagree with me, you know, I listen to them, and he brought that kind of human touch to what he was doing.
Yeah, that's very true. That's very true. He was a good listener, as well as being a good speaker, and in many cases a powerful speaker on various issues. But I can tell you firsthand what a good listener he was as well, and really I think quickly could hear people's concerns and their needs in a very good way.
Yeah.
But I think there are many people. You know, one of the things that happened after Paul's death is his two sons established, along with his former campaign manager, Wellstone Action, which is a kind of a training camp for beginning candidates and also campaign organizations.
Yeah. I myself
and they have carried on the kind of legacy.
Yeah, I myself have actually attended a Wellstone training in Northfield at Carleton, sadly. It should have been at St. Olaf. But I would recommend it to anybody. You know, if anybody wants to go to wellstone.org, they can see the trainings that are offered there.
Yes, that's good. You know, basically trying to make sure that new candidates understood the kind of outreach to people that you needed to do in order to win a campaign, and linking with people, understanding their concerns, developing a message that showed that you were concerned about your constituents and concerned about the issues that really matter to them, and developing a way that spoke through your own progressive beliefs and values. That you could meet their needs.
Yeah.
So, I went through it twice. So I guess I was a slow learner perhaps, but went through the training twice and found it very valuable.
Yeah. In 2014, I worked on Al Franken's campaign as an organizer in South St. Paul and West St. Paul, and it was very, very apparent to me from the start, even from just like the initial hiring training, that Paul, it felt to me, you know, still played a very large role in DFL Minnesota politics. You know, all of the training guides and everything had quotes about Paul from Paul. You know, that really tried to aspire us to be the best people we could be, and that politics wasn't about personal gain or power games. It was really about improving people's lives. I'm curious, you know, you currently sit in the Minnesota State Legislature. What do you think Paul's legacy is in Minnesota politics?
Well, I would say a good number of folks who are Democrats in the Minnesota House and Senate have also gone through some of the training, and a number of them knew Paul when he served as a senator and were very inspired by him and his message. And I think sometimes we forget that not only was he very good at listening to people and picking up what their messages were, but he was able to show us how to be respectful and how to advance a progressive agenda in a way that was very positive. And I think those are things that that we need today, and that that good politicians who are trying to bring that back are aware of that and realize they owe a debt to Wellstone for that. I think one of the issues that that you see in current politics right now is whether or not we pursue an identity agenda or an economic agenda, we're somewhat divided on some of that. But I think that Paul had a unique understanding of how to bring all of those various strains together and talk about people's lives in a way that did bring people into our party and into our campaign in a very inspiring way. So I mean, he could talk about how to improve people's lives, and how he had that very common and popular phrase that he liked to quote: "We all do better when we all do better." But I think some people who were critical of his point of view might say, "Well, that's socialism," and he would respond, "Well, whatever you want to call it, if we're improving people's lives across the board, that's what I'm about, and that's what I'm campaigning for, right. And we should all be about that as Minnesotans."
Yeah, I mean, I wonder, is that I was researching you a little bit. That idea of putting an economic populism message, was that part of your thinking behind the middle class pamphlet and your approach?
Yeah, yes, very much so. I owe a lot to my thinking there about Paul's politics and trying to figure out a way that we have an economy and economics that really does address that issue of how we can all do better. I feel very strongly about that, and I think that it's a way of thinking about society and improving society that we can bring everyone along, regardless of your race or your background or whatever it might be. And we need to be very careful about not forgetting that we all want to move forward together.
I mean, something we're all three of us very interested in language and politics and approach. And, I know that Paul had this great line that he represents I think he said the people's wing or the progressive wing of the Democratic Party.
Yeah.
I always remember that. But going back to what we're saying, like something that in Pennsylvania, I'd be curious what my co-hosts think, that sometimes I feel like because we're one of the commonwealths, I feel like that very language gives us a framework to talk about an economy that helps all and avoid the socialism label, right? Like
it's our commonwealth.
It's our
common.
Like what are the commons that and things like you wrote about, like healthcare, transportation, education? Those are commons that that when they're better, we're all better.
Yeah.
Yes. Right. Yeah. More recently, I've been thinking about and I'd be interesting to have a conversation with Paul about this. But the right has sort of captured the word freedom for some time, but actually there's a way to think about freedom in terms of how we can't have freedom for everyone if we don't provide the various basic things that people need. And so, whether you think about education or access to healthcare or transportation, getting to your job or whatever it might be, those are all things that liberate you. They create opportunities. And if we don't invest in them, we are denying people the freedom to pursue their own interests. And I think the Democratic Party needs to sort of recapture that and talk more about how we can really liberate people and their potential if government and society can provide the things that people truly need at a basic level.
Right. It's like the pursuit of happiness doesn't mean much if you're starving and sick.
Yeah.
Yeah, right.
Chip, yeah. Do you want to? We're going to bring in our third co-host.
Well, I've been trying to hang back a little bit because both of these guys have such deep ties to Minnesota and DePaul, and I wanted them to have their moment. But if you wouldn't mind, the current governor of Minnesota, Mark Dayton.
Oh yeah, is that it?
He's a member of the DFL party, right?
Correct.
And he's doing extremely well. And I guess my question is, how do these, you know, with the state of affairs in the country right now and all the divisiveness and the far extremes kind of dominating the conversation, how do we put sensible, good people into positions of power? How do we get these people elected in other parts of the country? And to follow up with that, are you at all concerned about the path that we are on with the tone and the conversation that the country is having nationally?
Well, in answer to your last question, yes, I am. And, you know, I think we are seeing a president who's changing the norms of political discussion and endeavor that I'm not sure how we'll recover from them exactly, but it's unclear right now what direction we're going in, and I can see that the Republican Party is kind of struggling with that itself, as we hear from Flake and others who are, you know, senators who are saying, I'm not sure I like what's happening. And I think with some of the comments I made before about Paul's ability to talk seriously about issues, but not be disrespectful or not lose sight of the fact that we need to treat each other like human beings and not as, you know, something else.
Yeah, it seems like right now is almost exactly the kind of climate that we need someone like Paul. I mean, we need someone like him exactly right now.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah, and he was very good at modeling that kind of behavior. And really, I think people, regardless of your political stripes, when you talked with him, you realized you were talking to someone who truly cared about you and about the future of our country and our state. So, yeah, he was very impressive in that way. As to your question about, Mark Dayton is someone who also would tell you that he owed a lot to Paul Wellstone and the example of Paul Wellstone. Keith Ellison is another who would very strongly say Paul Wellstone was an idol for him and helped him achieve what he achieved. And I think also Keith is another example in the Wellstone model of somebody who can be, someone who can represent a caring person who is very respectful of, sometimes very disrespectful, other politicians. He is a black Muslim, and yet he commands a lot of respect in his own House district and in the state. I think there are a lot of people who respect him and see him as someone who lives in the lineage of Paul Wellstone.
Mm. Yeah, he's
so I think, I think in some ways, good politicians are helped by those kinds of examples and some of the training that the Wellstone Action Group does. And I think for me, when I look at other politicians, and I hope I live up to this myself, but there's always, of course, a certain amount of egoism when you put yourself out in something like this. But you look for someone who wants to run for office because they want to do something. They want to, like Paul, they want to improve people's lives rather than trying to run for office because it's something they can add to their curriculum vitae or something. You know, that they can say, well, I did all of this in the past, or I'm a great person, or this is all about me. And I think politics does attract people who are doing it because they want to achieve something for themselves rather than actually get something done for other people. And the politicians who come forward and see politics as what I would say is a higher calling, you know, not something that is dirty or disrespectful or, you know, I mean, you hear a lot from some politicians who are, you wonder why they're running for office because they're so critical of government and how wrong the politicians are.
Yeah.
You wonder why they're getting involved in it. But I think Paul viewed the political realm as something that was, you know, worth getting involved in, and in many ways a higher calling, that this is something that you're called to serve other people, you're called to to engage in the political discussion, and people have different ideas, and we need to respect those ideas and entertain them, but come up with the best ideas that really make life better for people.
Yeah.
Well, I tell you, the country's in dire need of more voices like Paul Wellstone, and right now today is especially a hard day for us.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Wrap up, do you have any, you know, kind of personal memories or anecdotes or something about Paul that maybe isn't as well known that you wanted to share?
Well, I can, you know, the encounters that I've had with Paul personally, whether it was, you know, walking the streets and handing out, you know, canvassing and talking to potential constituents or whatever it might be, he had an infectious nature where he was excited to be out there visiting with people, and he would show as much interest in as he was walking along talking to you as he would to anyone, you know. And he was interested to know what you cared about, what you wanted to do, and with your life and things like that. So it was always a thrill to see him and talk with him. He was one of those kinds of people that kind of engendered that feeling that you were talking to someone who, you know, was a good person and inspiring person. I do remember, this was probably a week and a half before he was killed in the accident. We were campaigning in 2002, and I was running for office that year myself, and I was out. He drove by my house. I was raking leaves in my front yard.
Was that in August?
Over and, this was actually in October.
Okay, so I was trying to get a Minnesota joke, you know, in.
Okay. Anyway, he stopped and said, "What are you doing?" And I said, "Well, I'm working on my lawn." He said, "Well, you should be out door knocking. You should be out campaigning."
Hell,
you
know? Yeah.
Yeah.
Because we were getting close to the day of the election, so...
Oh, that's great.
Always trying to inspire. Yeah.
Representative Bly, thank you so much for talking with us. We really appreciate it. We'll get this episode out. We have a few more things to add here, but we'll be sure to tag you in our post and send it to you. Thank you so much.
Thank you for your time, yeah, your service, you and I hope we can talk again someday.
So we're back here.
Oh, we are back.
Now we're back. Yeah, we had a brief audio.
It's like he's trying to.
Where it's like, yeah, we're long on quality, short on production values.
So yes, still a.
Well, Taylor, thank you. That was a real treat. We learned. You know, we didn't know that David Bly was the chair of the county DFL.
Yeah, during the time of Paul Wellstone's first election. Honestly, I feel like David was Representative Bly was probably the best person that we could have talked with about Paul, Senator Wellstone. I thought that was you really got a sense of who Paul was and the legacy that he's left.
Yeah. You know, I was kind of thinking like 1990. You know, how much was he? How much was Paul like a mold breaker or mold creator for, you know, the outside candidate, the insurgent candidate? There was also, you know, at that time it was this whole like end of history kind of zeitgeist, you know, the Soviet Union was collapsing.
Yeah.
And the Eastern Bloc, and here he, and he was the only, I read this, he was the,
he's
only,
the only
person,
incumbent that, the only or person, person that beat
an incumbent that year.
In 1990.
And so, you know, how much does Bill Clinton or Barack Obama, is Elizabeth Warren, you know, other people, I don't know if Bill Clinton counts as an insurgent type candidate, but anyway, how much was it was in the roots of that? That was an interesting thing.
Yeah.
You know, the infectiousness, I was looking at some video that the Carleton Archives, shout out to Nate from the Carleton College Archives, put together for me, and it was a rally from 1990, from the day of the election, and you could see the infectiousness. I mean, Paul's going around talking to people, soon to be Senator Wellstone. I put it up on Facebook, and some people who were ahead of me but went to Carleton, like, were starting to respond. I'm hoping, you know, we might have a follow-up and get some other people to have some memories. You know, it was one of those moments where you feel like there's a real possibility for progress, like when he won.
Yeah. So we're going to play some clips and then briefly talk about them. The first one will be on...
The first one is about... these are from a speech that Senator Wellstone gave in 1992 at Carleton. We had a thing every Friday called Convocation, so there were no classes, and they would bring in different speakers of different stripes. And so I was listening to it, and I pulled out a few quotes. So we'll listen to those, and we'll have some response. Wait, I want to say one more thing real quick about Paul's legacy while we're in this part. So probably my closest connection in a way to him was a secondary connection. He had a very good friend named Mike Casper, who's a physics professor at Carleton. And Mike went and was a policy advisor to Paul for a couple of years. And he came back and he taught a class that I took. And Paul and Mike had spent a lot of time in the 80s and 70s working on energy policy and rural energy policy in Minnesota. And Mike taught this class where it was called like energy policy, but what we really did was go through campaign finance reports of all the people who were on the Senate Energy Committee and track down who was giving them money to build like the ammunition for him and Paul to say like the energy policy they were debating is totally being bought and paid for by.
That's so
it was really cool, and it was really like,
yeah,
you know, I learned so much about what how politics really works. And this was like pre-internet, so we had to like, I think we had to download the reports, maybe over computer, but we had to go through them by hand and track stuff down.
You couldn't find it.
No,
you know,
there were no opensecrets.org.
Yeah.
And it was, you know, for a college class, it was like, you know, I'd go from reading poetry or whatever to like, and he was very upfront. He was like, yeah, basically you're like the opposition research arm for the Paul Wellstone office.
That's great. One more thing, you know, I just really quickly want to thank David Bly again, Representative David Bly. You can find his website, davidbly.com. You can also buy his book, We All Do Better, at wealldobetter.com. So with that, we'll
put some links in.
And we'll put some links in. And with that, we'll play this clip.
I think they all go together. I think electoral politics without grassroots organizing is a politics without a base. I think grassroots organizing without electoral politics can be a marginal politics. And I think electoral politics and grassroots organizing without policy and program is a movement without a direction and without a head. And so I think you have to put those ingredients together.
I was going to say about the three. Oh, we're recording. So we just listened to Paul talk about these three pieces, a movement without policy is...
They've listened to it. They basically, he's talking about how the three essential pillars of political change are public policy,
mm-hmm.
electoral organizing, and grassroots organizing.
Right.
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 Yeah, I mean,
But so I guess the interesting question is, why is that so hard to recreate? Like, we know that, but it doesn't happen enough, right?
Yeah, I mean, I
to be honest with you, what's been on my mind the most since the call earlier and, you know, learning more about Paul is forming a DFL party here.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and that's a hybrid party.
Yeah.
That wins consistently in rural districts in Minnesota and now controls the governorship.
Well, it's the DFL party and the Democratic Party.
I love your ability to wrestle the agenda and take it right where you want to. You're like one of those cowboys who like wrestles the baby steers.
The roper.
Microphone's right there.
Oh, so yeah, I think that would be an interesting thing to talk about in another podcast. Yeah. I mean, the thing that I got out of this was this quote is also like, I just like the rhetorical style that, you know, this without great. That, yeah. this without that. And you know, maybe it'd be interesting, like, if we were to go back and say, well, are we now, you know, a movement without electoral politics that's marginalized? I mean, I think that's where sometimes a lot of, like, progressives or people who are like, well, I hate the Democratic Party, so therefore I'm going to go independent or green. Well, then you become marginalized.
Yeah.
What was the other one? Like a movement without...
Public policy is a movement without direction.
Without direction.
Yeah.
I mean, you could make, I'm going to say this, and we'll see if we're popular and the Twitter stuff comes in. You know, if you're doing identity politics only, right, if you're only sort of doing a politics of, like, we're not represented, maybe that's an example of that, right? You're not actually addressing what could make lives better. I realize that may not be a fair characterization of identity politics, but...
Yeah, no, I mean, I think it's actually a pretty straight-on critique of identity politics. It's not grounded in... In hardcore public policy.
It's like saying there is racism. Like, well, yes, but how are we going to overcome that?
Yeah.
All right.
The DFL party coming to rural PA.
Okay. Yeah.
Hit pause.
Last critical ingredient that I hope will be written up in a couple of books that are being done on the campaign was the grassroots part. As a political scientist, I got to say it one more time. It didn't make sense to try and play by the usual rules of the game, to try and match a TV campaign and big money campaign and media manipulation campaign running the same thing when you didn't have the money. In any case, I didn't believe in it. We went grassroots, and with 4 days to go, without exaggeration, we made 700,000 get out the vote calls in 4 days. Don't think there's been a statewide race anywhere in the country quite like that. And a good many of the women and men who made those calls were students, including high school students, all across the country.
Well, 700,000 phone calls, 1990, pre-internet technology in 4 days.
That's pretty good.
What did the operative say?
He's lying.
I don't know how we'd
verify that. Yeah.
I mean, you're talking almost 200,000 calls a day over a 10-hour window.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
somebody calls.
If you had 20,000 volunteers,
you'd have to have thousands of volunteers, and you know, not for nothing. I've been doing this a while. A lot of those guys, don't really. I mean, that's a lot of calls.
Jeff's been doing it for a while. That's 14.
Are you accusing
million.
Him of? I had the largest inauguration.
Yeah, my crowd. No, I'm not. I just, it's either, I can't, of course I'm not calling him a liar, but that's an amazing thing in 1990.
That's the lightning in the bottle that people keep overlooking. Yeah. And then I feel like, you know, one of my ongoing critiques of sort of not politics policy, but how campaigns are run is this, well, we have to have enough money to have enough media buys.
Yeah.
It's this like total kind of, you know.
Yeah. And sometimes I'm guilty of that as well, you know.
Not that the media buys don't matter, but you know, what's going to win? Getting voters to the polls.
Something that I think that I
another thing we should mention also is that those phone calls don't make as much difference anymore.
That's totally true. That's definitely accurate. One thing that I think was sort of like a early like, oh, you know, a political lesson for me that it like when I'm voicing this out loud, it makes you know, it makes me sound like an idiot, but, you know, just, like, to truly
please,
get this
please
lesson,
say it then.
Like, you have to play to your strengths and don't play towards your weaknesses. Mm-hmm. Like, and, like, that's a very real political lesson that I feel like many people neglect. You know, they run this box, you know, cookie cutter.
Like, do you think
Ossoff
didn't follow that? Because, like, instead of playing to his strengths, he tried to avoid seeming like a neophyte and a liberal. Like, he tried to run as, like, a... very moderate Democrat.
Yeah.
Was that one of the
think,
you know, I don't know. Like this is what I mean. It's like, you know, it's like if you know, for Wellstone, he was never going to raise the money, but he did. He was extremely inspiring, so it made sense for him to run a grassroots campaign. You know, if somebody, you know, tried to run Wellstone's campaign that was like totally uninspiring and could raise a lot of money, like that would be a stupid call too.
Like Chip.
Yeah, if Chip tried to run a Wellstone style campaign, he would.
But we know he's got a lot of money.
Yeah, so
I just was amazed at, you know, and kind of piggybacking on that idea that there was clarity in his voice. It was clarity of thought. He knew what he was talking about. He was talking from a position of, like you said, he ran a campaign that he could run. He didn't try and run a campaign that wasn't in his personal style, that didn't reflect his values. And that led to, for me, listening to the man speak, It's the clarity in his vision, and it's the voice. It's that strong voice. He was confident, and he's confident because he was doing it from a place of truth.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And I think that's important for all of our candidates to realize: if you're not comfortable running some of these tactics, then don't run them, and be true to yourself. And that's how you connect.
Yeah.
That's how you get people to make 700,000 calls. Is because there's that human element.
Yeah.
That connection that people can feel it when you're talking from the heart. And Paul Wellstone spoke from his heart, and people felt it, and they made 700,000 calls. It's remarkable.
Yeah, no, that's awesome. You know, I think, you know, as...
How many doors have you knocked on in East Buffalo race? Not you personally, but the campaign?
The campaign, like a few thousand.
So that's great.
Yeah.
That's unprecedented, isn't it?
698,000 to go. Wellstone.
Oh, my God.
Come on.
If only
Paul Wellstone was running Tony Stafford.
Yeah. No. But knocking on 700,000 doors in East Buffalo Township, that'd mean that every person would get like...
1,000 knocks.
1,000 knocks. More than that. 2,000 knocks each.
You'd get a...
An order of protection. Yeah.
voter stalking.
Yeah. But I think this, you know, this... You know, if we have any candidates out there that are running right now, you know, if you talk with operatives, they, you know, they'll say, oh, you need to write a campaign plan and start raising money, like, immediately, you know, like, get your first 50K in the bank, and then let's talk about, like, no. The first step is an honest reflection of what are my strengths as a person? What are my weaknesses as a person? What are the strengths of my candidacy? What are the weaknesses of my candidacy? And then structuring your campaign from there. Paul did that really well, and he won.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So we'll see you at the next episode of Barnstorming PA.
Episode 10!
Bye, y'all. Mary, St. Mary, Chick, Chitty, Big Chitty, I'm a dandy, I've been everywhere, man. I've been everywhere, man.